You are now listening to the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Daniel Lee of Photos by DLEE. Today is also our first episode for the 2023, so yay to that. I had a nice break, I've been away so long, I forget. As always, today we're going to be talking about getting to know your camera, some news updates, and some personal updates, which I will start now. So, as I was starting to get into, I had a great break over Christmas, enjoyed my time off of work. It's amazing how fast, like, time goes when you're not working. I had 10 days in total of annual leave, and that 10 days flew by. It felt like the first, 7 just went by so fast, and it was already that weekend before I go back to work, and I couldn't believe it. We have another public holiday in a few weeks for Australia Day, so I'm really looking forward to that again. Any public holiday, I love these days, just purely because it means a paid day off, so how can you not enjoy that? During the Christmas break, I think I mentioned last year, I decided to do another 52-week project, something to get me shooting weekly and get me using my camera. And I did say, I wanted to do something a bit more, not just take a photo for the sake of taking a photo, try and tell a story or try and do something a bit better each week. So far, the first week was fireworks photos, which I hadn't actually shot properly, like on a tripod, that kind of thing, since moving to Sydney. So that sort of was a bit of a story. The next one was about, how I needed a new self-portrait. I love WWE, so that's where my new WWE holding the world title self-portrait came in. Next week, I already have an idea of what I'm going to shoot. Just need to sort of execute it, so that'll be a bit interesting. It's more of a product shot. I'm kind of avoiding product photography because the more I do it, the more I realize how much I need that macro lens, and I really don't want to spend right now. We got holiday coming up, just need to save in general, other stuff I want to do. So I'm trying to resist as much as I can. I'm trying to just shoot, say, with the 85 of close to minimal focusing distance, then crop it as an alternative. But obviously, it's not the same as having a macro. So I think it's only about $800 to buy one. Even my wife was pushing me to buy one day. So I think I will have to give in eventually. But that time that I'm going to give in isn't quite yet. I did start to shoot a bit more because of that 52-week project, and I've been trying to shoot casually. I do feel I really need to train my eye again. Technical wise, exposing, editing, all that kind of stuff, I feel like I have no issue with. I always maintain that. Whereas my composition, that kind of stuff, and my creativity, that's where I need to really put in my effort and put the work in and sort of retrain myself. I prefer to have it, up to date and really good by the time I go to Japan, so I can get some really great images. Aside from just great cityscapes, I want to capture everything really nicely. So we'll see how we go. Need to just practice as much as I can before I go, because, photography is a skill. The more you do it, the better you'll be at it. And in terms of that holiday, I've used so many different setups. I did a whole episode on this. I'm mostly set on taking a 35-85 and 16-35 combo to Japan. So I feel like I'm just going to use a 35 GM for literally almost everything. When I go to certain locations that I'm going to try and research and I know I want to shoot wide, that's when the 16-35 will come out. Otherwise, I'll just be using a 35. And then sometimes if I want to go out at night or a certain location, like when we go Mount Fuji, shooting it from a distance, I'll probably end up using an 85. How it's going to work, we'll see how we go. I was originally thinking of taking the Fuji, but I think I'm just going to use Sony only this time. Sorry, Fuji, but who knows? Maybe I'll change my mind again before then, because I did try walking around on New Year's Eve with both cameras, 16-35 on the Sony and the 33mm on the Fuji. My back didn't hurt. I got some great shots. Funny enough, I actually ended up using the Fuji more, because I like the 50mm look for what I was shooting, but we'll see how we go. We're also pretty much halfway through summer exactly now. Today is the 15th at the time of recording, so yeah, not much longer now. Then thankfully, I hate this stupid daylight savings can be over, sunset can be earlier, and as I say every year this winter, I gotta go out as much as I can to make the most of, the early sunsets and get some city. To be honest, I don't even know about cityscapes anymore, because I feel like I've shot every location I really can and enjoy, so maybe I'll try something different in that weather. Do more self-portraits or do something outside of the house. Go to parks, shoot nature. Yeah, that's pretty much it for my personal updates. So onto the news. New year, new lenses being announced. So Sigma has announced the release of their 60-600mm f4.5 to f6.3 DGDN OS lens, which it calls the world's first only 10x ultra telephoto zoom lens for mirrorless cameras. I believe there was an older DG lens for HSM for DSLRs, but I don't even remember that lens, so this seemed like a brand new lens to me originally. The lens itself is constructed of 27 elements in 19 groups, including 3 special low dispersion elements and 2 F low dispersion elements. It has a minimum focusing distance of 45 centimeters, which is 17.7 inches at 60 millimeters, and 2.6 meters or 102.4 inches at 600 millimeters. 105 millimeter front filter thread has a 9-bladed aperture diaphragm and delivers a 1:2:4 magnification ratio at 200 millimeters. Has a high response linear actuator HLA autofocus system, which is the first time Sigma is using a linear motor in its lenses. It also has Sigma's dual action zoom, which allows users to adjust the zoom either by using the zoom ring or pulling the front of the lens, which is always great to be able to have that option. And you know, you by mistake pull the lens, you're worried it's going to damage it, but this lets you do either one. The lens has OIS, which Sigma claims the updated algorithm offers up to 7 stops of exposure compensation at 60mm and up to 6 stops at 600mm, which is impressive if true. Sigma claims the lens is dust and splash resistant, with seals on all of the major areas to minimize the chance of water and debris from getting inside the lens. Other features include a focus limiter switch, free customizable AFL buttons, and an interchangeable tripod socket, in compatibility with Sigma's 1.4 and 2x L-mount teleconverters. The lens is manufactured in Sigma's IZ Japan production facility and will start shipping mid-February 2023 for $1,999, which is honestly pretty reasonable for the range it provides and the max aperture. I think this is going to be a great lens, very popular. It's interesting that they're doing these longer telephoto zooms rather than something like a 50mm 1.4, which still hasn't been updated. I actually thought that lens would be updated a lot sooner than it has been, considering, you know, that one, there's no real good high-end autofocus Sony 50mm f1.4. But when you look at it, that other Zeiss one, I think, is known to have a few issues. It's quite dated as well. The Sigma one's quite big and heavy. Maybe they're trying to get the most out they can out of that new lens, the DN, make it smaller, make it something very unique. But I guess we'll eventually see what it does. Next up, Nikon announces development of an 85mm f1.2 S-line lens for Z-mount cameras. They also announced another lens which we'll cover, but Nikon has announced it's developing this lens for Z-mount camera systems. A few details are provided by Nikon regarding its new ultra-fast telephoto prime. The only spec available has an 82mm front filter thread, which wasn't even properly announced. It's more just on the photos you can see that. From videos I've seen from CES, someone holding the lens, it does look like to be quite a big, hefty lens. But other features that are visible in the image include auto manual toggle for autofocus, at least one function button, a control ring, and a large rubberized focus ring, as well as the Nikkor 50mm f1.2 and 85 1.2. This lens will also have another rubberized ring, presumably for added additional grip, considering, you know, the hefty size. No pricing or availability information has been provided, but I'd assume it will be similar to either Canon's lens or somewhere around that range as well. Nikon has simultaneously announced the development of a 26mm f2.8 pancake lens for the APS-C cameras. The only specification known for that one is its focal length and the f2.8 aperture. It does look like it has a filter thread ring, but there was nothing in the images to say exactly what size that was, and there's no pricing or availability info on either of these lenses yet. It's always good that, you know, they're releasing more and more lenses for the Z-mount system for their users. If both Canon and Nikon do have an 85 1.2, I assume Sony wouldn't be that far behind either. It would be really great to see what all three of the brands can make from one. I think Sony's pricing would be interesting, considering how they price their other lenses, like their 51-2. Here, Sony's 51-2 at least is about 2500 AUD, whereas Canon's is about $1,000 more. So be interesting where Nikon fits in that pricing thing. Next up, the Panasonic Lumix DC S5-2 and S5-2X have been announced. So the S5-2 is the company's latest version of their mid-range full-frame stills and video mirrorless camera. Panasonic also announced that S5-2X, which is a variant more extensive video feature set, which will arrive later in the year. Not long ago, Panasonic did say they were going to be focusing more on video side than the still side of things. So it'll be interesting what happens because of that. This camera has a 24 megapixel BSI CMOS sensor with an on-phase detection. So if you on-sensor phase detection. So if you didn't know, previously they use contrast detection. So if you think back to old cameras, like your old Nikon DSLRs, Canon DSLRs, like 5D3 and earlier, they had contrast detect. So when you would focus in live view, it would be really slow, go back and forth, and then finally nail focus. It was very accurate, but it was extremely slow. And then apparently Panasonic had this up until recently, but now they finally have on-sensor phase detection, which is like all your Sony cameras, Canon, Nikon mirrorless. On-sensor phase detection is the best there is, you know, currently. So it's great to see that they're actually going forward with that. So they're going to be very, very, you know, sort of different now. Back to the rest of the specs. So it has up to 30 frames per second in e-shutter, shooting with continuous AF and RAW capture, 96 megapixel multi-shot high resolution mode, dual conversion gain sensor with explicit dual native ISO gain selection, a cooling fan, twin UHS-II card slots, additional features for the S5 2X are all video related, and you know, I'm not really that much into video, so I won't, you know, be including those. But the good thing is it does have subject recognition now for animals and humans, along with updated IBIS. So quite a lot of features. It's a great thing. So if you're already using Panasonic or you are more video orientated, but do want to be able to do stills as well, this is going to be a great option for you. The S5 II will be available from the last week of January for a recommended price of $1,999, which is included there is €2,199, with the S5 2X not hitting the shelves until the end of May. The S5 2X will command the $200 or €300 premium over the less video-centric version. An optional paid upgrade for the S5 II will also add raw video output and will cost $200 or €200 as well. So quite a lot of options. Competition is great, so it's really good to see Panasonic getting this. You know, they're part of the L-Mount Alliance, so there's a huge amount of lenses, not so much natively from Panasonic, but you got so many Sigma lenses and Leica and all that. You got a lot of options if you do want to shoot Panasonic. I think most of them use a Sony sensor as well, which is another great thing. So it'd be interesting if they develop this themselves or they're just buying Sony sensors with that autofocus features built in. I don't know how it would work, but it'd be interesting if this is their autofocus or Sony's autofocus. So if it's Sony's, it's a huge win then, because Sony does have great autofocus. But even if it's from what I've seen in video previews and reviews sort of thing, it does look very good regardless of who developed it. The last story is Panasonic Lumix S 14-28mm f4 to f5.6 macro lens for L-mount camera systems has been announced. So this is a new wide-angle lens designed purely for L-mount camera systems. The lens itself is constructed of 14 elements in 10 groups, including one aspherical extra low dispersion element, one aspherical element, three extra low dispersion elements, and one high ultra refractive index element. Minimum focusing distance of 15 centimeters across the entire zoom range for a 0.25 times to a 0.5 magnification ratio at 14 millimeters and 28 millimeters respectively. So not macro in traditional one-to-one sense. Panasonic claims the lens autofocus system can support frame rates up to 240 frames per second. The lens will have both linear and non-linear focus ring modes with selectable sensitivity in both modes. And one feature includes a weather-resistant design, other features, a 77mm front filter thread and 7-bladed aperture diaphragm. This lens will weigh around 345 grams and it will start shipping at the end of March 2023 for around $799. Once again, you know, great option to have. Some people do like wide-angle lenses for macro work. It's not really a traditional macro, so I don't even know if it would be called that. It's sort of like how Canon have all them, you know, 85, 35, 24 macro lenses that aren't true macro. They're not one-to-one. They're just more close-focusing. I would call this more of a close-focusing lens because that magnification isn't quite there. Either way, it's quite a versatile lens, so I'm sure people get a lot of use out of it, so maybe you're one of them. Otherwise, that's pretty much it for the news, so we'll get on to the main topic. So it's always great to get a new camera. You know, the camera itself, though, isn't always perfect right out of the box. I'm sure, you know, with the holidays just passing, maybe someone bought a camera on sale or they got a camera as a gift. So you might be wondering where to start if you're that new to everything, or maybe you're not new, but you just got a new camera. You don't know what you should be doing when you get something new. It's always great to customize them and get to know them if you want the maximum performance out of them. Because, you know, no matter how good the camera is, if you don't know how to use it, you're not going to be able to do it. Imagine if you had a car. It doesn't matter. If I give you, say, a Lamborghini, Ferrari, anything, and it's a manual or a stick shift, as some people call it. If you don't know how to drive it, you can only drive auto. You're not going to be able to drive it to its full capacity or speed. You actually know how to use it. The same with a camera. No matter what, you could put in the auto, but it's not going to be able to expose or shoot as well as if you actually control everything and have it set up the way you want it. Now, there's quite a few ways to do this, so I thought I'd go over some as usual. Now, the first one is customizing the menus and shooting modes. So no matter which camera brand you get, it's always good to customize your settings, and there's always stuff that you should be adding to a custom menu. So for me personally, what I add to the custom menu, now, depending on the camera, there can be bulb options. So on your Canon, Fuji, that kind of stuff, maybe not so much Fuji, but say for example, Canon, you have the bulb timer. That's something that I would add there. Maybe time-lapse settings or interval shooting, that kind of stuff. If you're doing focus bracketing or that, that's a great one to add to turn on quickly. If you're someone that for some reason swaps between RAW and JPEG quite often, you could have those set in there very quickly and easy. I usually have IBIS set in there, which shutter mode I have. Now, some of these ones are better off in the custom menus or sort of thing, depending on what camera you get. So for example, with Canon, they don't have too many custom menus and buttons, whereas Sony, you have a ton of, or not, sorry, menus, but buttons. With Sony, you have a ton of custom buttons. So I like to have one set to white balance, one set to which type of focus mode I want to use, when I want to use wide, focus on the whole area, what I want to use spot. I have another one set to swap between electronic shutter and mechanical shutter. Because, you know, sometimes if, for example, I'm shooting something without a bokeh, I want to be able to go into mechanical. Or, for example, you know, if I'm in electronic, but I know the scene is a bit tough and I want to get the maximum dynamic range, sometimes, depending on the camera, it can be a lower bit mode. So because of that, it's going to, you know, you want to have the maximum amount of dynamic range. So obviously, by doing that, you know, you can make sure you're in the right mode. Then stuff like IBIS. So one friend suggested to me that if your body has IBIS and you want to make sure when you're on a tripod you're not using it, use your custom mode. So on most cameras, you have C1, C2, C3, maybe C4 or more. What you can do is you can have like a C1, for example, is landscape mode, where when you swap to that, it's set the same as your normal camera modes, but IBIS is always disabled in C1. So that way, when you're doing a landscape or you're on a tripod, you know straight away, turn off, you know, C1. This is something I really need to set up on my Fuji, especially because every time I use it on a tripod, I tend to forget to disable IBIS. So I've never got something that's at its true sharpness because of that. But I definitely suggest setting up at the minimum, set up some custom menus, custom buttons, that kind of stuff. If you're used to having a certain button on one camera, do something. If you have a similar spot on that one, try set the same so that way you don't have as much shock when you swap between cameras. The next one I would suggest is to test your IBIS limit. So with IBIS, it definitely is different per camera. I do notice that on Canon, the IBIS was much better compared to on Sony. Do have to keep in mind, Canon IBIS was designed to work in conjunction with Lens IS. I don't know if Sony one was. I don't believe it was. I can't say for certain though. But I also have to keep in mind that with the Sony one, you know, most Sony lenses don't have image stabilization, whereas with Canon, majority are built to have it there. So that would obviously make quite a bit of difference. Either way, it's good to know exactly what your limit is. So say you're always shooting with a 50mm lens. It's good to know how much lower under 50mm you can go and still get a sharp image. I find with Sony, I am horrible at getting sharper images because of I got so used to Canon. Canon, I could be very lazy with how low my shutter speed was. It was honestly really possibly the best IBIS out of anybody I've used out of Sony, Fuji, and Canon. They definitely had amazing IBIS. With Sony, I do feel like I need to be a bit more strict with how I'm shooting. There's also, I have to keep in mind as well, with Sony, I do have a lot faster lenses, so that does make a difference as well in terms of, you know, my depth of field will never be as large because, you know, compared to shooting like, say, 85mm, 85 at f1.4 is very, very shallow, whereas f2, still shallow, but not as crazy shallow. So that does make a difference of how much of the image will be in sharpness. So it could trick you in that sense as well. But either way, it's a good idea to know how far you can push it, what you're, you know, how good you are at hand holding. So that way, if you do have a scenario where you got a really important shot you need to take, you need to take quick, you know exactly, say, you know, your normal settings would be you need 1/100th of a second, but you know you can easily hand hold at 1/50th. You can do that without worries and don't have to be concerned about, you know, you only get chance to take one shot. And that one shot you tried too slow and then you couldn't get the shot. It was blurry because of that. So it's very good to have an idea of how all of this works. Now, next up, I would say finding out which AF mode works best for you. So although I always use Canon, growing up, you know, not growing up, but originally when I first used Canon, I would always use AFS for everything. I would never ever use continuous. And I did find I'd always miss focus. I do honestly believe if I'd used continuous focus, this may have helped quite a bit on DSLRs, but for some reason, I just never use it. Then when I swapped to Sony, I noticed everyone says that you should only use continuous because Sony cameras are optimized for that, which is true. So I got used to using continuous and I've always used that since, whether I use Fuji or Canon. You know, Fuji I think suits AFS better, maybe a bit more than continuous, but regardless, I still use continuous because that's, you know, my shooting style now. But it is a good idea to test your camera and see which mode works better for you and which you get better results with. Obviously, you don't have to do this in a proper shoot or anything. Anything, just around the house, see which AF mode is the most responsive. You know, some cameras do have quirks and things, like for example, with Fuji, you know, they find eyes in anything. You could take a photo of your couch and it'll find an eye somewhere in it. I don't know where it can see spirits or something, but yeah, Fuji are a bit tricky like that. So it's best to know, you know, for example, ties back to that custom buttons. With Fuji, if you're taking a photo of something, it's good to have a button set up that can quickly disable eye autofocus, because if you know you're trying to take a photo of a flower, for example, it keeps finding an eye. The eye will often be not where you want to focus, so it'll keep drifting over to there. So you quickly disable IAF, the camera works a lot better. On cameras like Canon and Sony, I never had that sort of issue, but I generally always just, you know, using AFC, but it really comes down to you testing the camera, seeing which autofocus mode works best for you. And depending on the brand of your camera, that may be AFC, like, or continuous AF or AF single, you know, single shot kind of stuff. Next one up is testing your dynamic range. So you may say, I don't care about dynamic range. And to an extent, I don't either, but it is good to know how far you can push your camera. I don't mean, you know, shoot 5 stops underexposed and then see what you can recover. But at the same time, if, you know, say for older Canon cameras, for example, they would favor the highlights more, whereas newer ones are very sensitive on the highlights and have a lot more latitude in the shadows. So when you know what your camera is best suited for, you can sort of shoot to match that. So say, for example, your camera has great shadow recovery, but not great highlight recovery. So what you want to do is, you know, just test around and see how much you can overexpose those highlights. Maybe you got a very dynamic scene where the shadows are super dark, highlights are super bright. Properly expose your highlights, dial it up maybe 2/3 of a stop or something. And which, to be honest, this is a lot easier when you have zebras like on Sony and Canon. You can see, you know, just get that high as bright as you can without blowing anything and then shoot it that way. Then that way you can recover your shadows in post and still save your highlights as well. But it's always good to just see exactly what your camera can do and the max, you know, you can get out of it without having to worry about missing a shot or something not being exposed correctly. ISO performance is a good idea to get an idea of. So for example, on Canon, I could shoot 8 for ISO 8, 10K, everything, and it would still be really, really clean. That R6 sensor was insanely good, and I believe the R6 II was meant to be very similar. But with Sony, I noticed it is a lot noisier. So being 33 megapixels, it is higher resolution, but it's also because, you know, larger amount of pixels, each individual pixel is smaller, so that does equal in more noise. So it's a good idea to get an idea of that once how high you can push your sort of ISO without having to worry about losing detail or the image not being savable, that kind of stuff. And for some reason, if you were to own a DSLR still, or that's a new camera you bought, all to you, but one good thing to do is test your lenses and do autofocus micro adjust. So if you have a body that has that, which is pretty much letting you move the mirror back and forth to match your lens. So if your lens is consistently back focus, it'll move the focus mirror there to match that. So that way your images will be in focus. But look up a thing called the dot tune method. It's pretty much calibrating it with your live view. So that way you can get your images in focus a lot more, and you need to do that stuff regularly. But if you do use a DSLR, that one will probably be the best option for you. Otherwise, that's it. Those are the sort of main things I would suggest doing when you first get your new camera. Probably one last one I'll probably throw in there that I didn't say is make sure you get good memory cards as well to suit what kind of camera you have. I know it can depend. When I had my Sony a7 III, I had UHS 1 cards, and it would be a nightmare just to load everything, to save. It would take so long. As soon as I got UHS 2 cards, it felt like a new camera because of how much faster it was. So that's one last bonus tip, is make sure you get memory cards that suit what you're shooting and what kind of your camera requirements are. But yeah, otherwise, that's it. That's all of them. Thank you for listening to the first episode of 2023. If you want to subscribe to me, all the links are in the show notes. If you want to find more podcast episodes and reviews, which I will hopefully have more of soon, you can go to thephotographyenthusiast.com. If you want to see me and my personal work, my 52-week project, that's at photosbydlee.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter at photosbydlee. I'm also on Reddit now at photosbydlee. All of this in the show notes, easy for you to find. If you did enjoy the episode, please leave a rating in Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I would greatly appreciate it. Otherwise, thank you very much. Stay safe. I hope the year started off well for you, and it's going to be a great year as well. Otherwise, take care. See you later.